You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, music in your head. Brain signals sing along.
The brain tracks next note probability and melodies. The brain tracks melodic contour. The brain stores and integrates idioms and melodies that can be retrieved. We have semi-successfully turned brain data into melodies.
Music in your head and beneath your feet.
There are sounds of organisms that we don't even imagine, recorded ants singing. Well, what they were doing, they weren't really singing, they were stridulating. They were rubbing their legs on their abdomen and creating this sound and trying to draw the other ants away from the hole that we had dropped our microphone, a little lavalier microphone, into.
Then there are those who don't want to listen.
I keep thinking of this, you know, in the time of these protests, of war, of situations where more and more we encounter people that simply do not want to listen to certain things, absolutely not. What do we do? That's the big question. When people refuse to listen.
Listen up. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm Dave Kattenberg. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. What makes music funky? What makes it thrilling, sad, offbeat, or downright strange? What makes you hum along before you even know what notes come next? Music in your brain. I spoke about all this with Roger Dumas. Dumas is a neuromusicologist and brain audio innovator with a long and interesting career, having introduced Janet Jackson, Prince, and other hip artists to the Moog synthesizer. Roger took up research work at the University of Minnesota's Brain Sciences Center. That's where we spoke back in 2014.
We have learned that the brain tracks next note probability and melodies. We have learned that the brain tracks melodic contour, and also the brain stores and integrates idioms and melodies that can be retrieved. We have semi-successfully turned brain data into melodies heard by our subjects.
I'm not quite sure what that means, turning brain data into music.
Well, it's...
These are electrical signals that can obviously be transduced into a melody.
That's right. Yes. So we extract the melody from the brain data and play it back. And as Martin Mull said, talking about music is like dancing about architecture. Would you like to hear it?
Yes, please.
Okay. We played 8 seconds of a melody to a subject. And the subject was in our magnetoencephalograph, so also known as MEG, which measures the electromagnetic fluctuation across the surface of the cerebral cortex. And this 8 seconds of data, which turns out to be over 8,000 samples stretched out over 248 sensors. So there's a lot of data just in this 8 seconds of music. We play that music. It sounds like this. All right. And then we ran linear regressions on the data for each sensor from this melodic contour, crunched the data down, did moving averages per note duration, and came up with a melodic contour from the data that sounds like this. So if I play these together, you'll hear that we're not far off.
So what you're saying is that when somebody listens to a passage of music and you record the electrical signal in the brain, you can take that electrical signal and play it back through a transducer, and it actually plays the music.
Yes.
So you could take somebody, suppose somebody who's heard something through a set of headphones, and you haven't heard what they've heard.
Yes.
And you could just record the electrical signals and play it back, and you can actually reproduce what they heard.
Yeah. Well, we're on the track to be able to do that. You know, my dream is to make a brain computer interface for synthesizers or brain musical instrument digital interface so that people could actually hear melodies that they're auditioning internally. We're not there yet, but we have been able to extract melodic contour from brain data.
So in other words, I could in my mind think about Beethoven's Ode to Joy.
Yes.
And you'd have no idea what I was listening to in my brain. But you could tell.
Yes. Well, that's right. We could. We could definitely discriminate between different melodies using this method. Getting the notes right, of course, is the trick. And the resolution for the data it's a little difficult to deal with at this point because we haven't quite figured out the formula that we need to translate data into musical notes, but we have the contour at this point, the gross contour of the melody.
And have you actually carried out that experiment, put somebody in a microencephalograph and said, play a tune in your head, and then said, oh, what you're listening to in your head is this?
Well, we have done something quite a bit like that. We have played the passage that you just heard with notes missing. So in each iteration of the melody, we remove a different note. And in the end, theoretically, if we put all these spaces together, we should have a representation of the original melody in the brain data.
So this is what you refer to as next note prediction?
No, that's different. That's next note probability. And that is based on the idea that people who are familiar with the musical genre, and everybody is because all cultures have music, they have two things in common. They have music and language, right? So people who are familiar with the music of their culture carry around in their heads a corpus of details, information, data about music here in Minnesota and the United States and even in the Western world. We're familiar with the Western classical music model, typically 12 tones. It's chromatic. Most melodies are comprise 7 notes in a scale, and we are familiar with modes, major and minor. We're familiar with accidentals, you know, chromatic instances in a melody that don't fit the scale but nevertheless are understood and appreciated. And so carrying around that corpus, this huge database of regularities in music, enables us to appreciate novelty. When we hear a new piece, we can refer to this model in our heads, compare it, and appreciate the differences, or revisit old thoughts about the music. So next note probability is determined by the frequency of the occurrence of a note pair in a corpus of music, Western musical tradition. We found this in a book called A Dictionary of Musical Themes. It's 10,000 musical themes, melodies, and 600 pages. We scanned every one of those pages and did optical character recognition on it and determined all of the note pairs for every melody in there. There are hundreds of thousands of these. Then we counted up how often a particular note pair shows up. And you get the frequency of occurrence, and you divide that by the total number of note pairs in the entire corpus, and you end up with the probability of the occurrence of three blind mice. Okay, so your brain automatically went to mice because you have this corpus in your head. You made a guess as to the probability of the next note, and you were correct. So we played Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring to 10 different subjects, and then we tracked the activity in their brains and correlated that with the probability, actually the minus log of the probability, which turns out to be a positive number and which we call a perplexity index. And we found that, especially on the right side of the brain, you have excitation. The brain responds to unexpected notes more than it does to expected notes. So if a note has a higher perplexity index, we see a jump in brain activity.
So, for example, if somebody were to be listening to Chinese music or something from Japan or something Arabic, they're not quite sure where to go when it comes to listening to a tune if they're not from that culture.
Well, you might be surprised how quickly people adapt. This experiment, the one you're suggesting, has been done on Finnish yoiks, which are folk songs. It's been done with Polynesians. People who are unfamiliar with one musical genre adapt very quickly, and they learn the regularities because there's some commonalities. For example, octave equivalents. All musics have octave equivalents. If I sing la and I go la, people would generally say that's the same note, only it's an octave higher. So brains are plastic, and music cognition it's real.
What's the practical application? Like, why should we? I mean, this is obviously a heck of a lot of fun.
Yes.
And a lot of people enjoy music. Like, everybody enjoys music.
Right.
And so it's interesting from just a creative point of view. But are there practical applications?
Well, sure there are. Lesion studies have shown us that people with lesions in certain parts of their brains have deficits in cognition, whether it be language or motor or even music. We can further define the problems that these people are having, or you know, zero in on their issues if we know more about their cognitive deficits. As I said before, you know, if we can figure out how to extract a melody from the brain, we could help people who are locked in communicate. Imagine if you're only able to blink one eye. If you had an EEG cap on that would send signals to a synthesizer, you could communicate very easily. You could respond to questions.
Simply by thinking. Roger Dumas is a neuromusicologist and Moog synthesizer pioneer. At the time of this conversation, Roger was working as a research associate at the University of Minnesota's Brain Sciences Center. To learn more about Roger Dumas's recent work on behavioral and neuroimaging and the validation of a musical chill identifying algorithm, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about Earth systems, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Silence, formerly sound-rich ecosystems bursting with bird songs and insect buzz that don't resonate like they used to. Earth's oceans, filled with sound wave artists of all sizes, have fallen silent too, apparently. Or maybe it's just human noise that drowns them out, along with all the chatter and noise in our heads. People need to quiet down, focus, and listen harder. They need to come to their auditory senses. Bernie Krause and Hildegard Westerkamp think so. Bernie Krause is a soundscape ecologist based in Northern California. Armed with various recording devices, Krause, the originator of the acoustic niche and biophony concept, has captured the sounds and songs of creatures large and small, above and below ground, and inside trees. Hildegard Westerkamp is a Vancouver-based composer, radio artist, and sound ecologist, and an alumnus of something called the World Soundscape Project. Westerkamp's soundscape installations and small group sound walks down Vancouver streets are renowned. Hello, Hildegard Westerkamp and Bernie Krause. Thank you for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Happy to be here.
Hello, David. Thank you for inviting us.
Is nature going silent?
Well, what we're finding here is that the density of bird life, meaning the total numbers of birds, is dropped off by about 80%. The diversity has remained pretty much the same. And I'm talking about a period of time from 2004 to the present. Some of that due to climate change, some of that due to fires that have occurred in this area. I live in Northern California and record a lot every year in the Mayacamas Mountains, the mountain range that divides Napa and Sonoma counties. And there's a great wildlife corridor up at the top of that that I've been recording at since 1993. So quite a long time. So I have a good track record of recordings of the density and diversity and how it's changed over time. And indeed, it has changed.
You're listening to bird sounds, and are you able to identify individual species from these?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we have 32 species of birds up in the Mayacamas where I record. And the diversity of birds, in other words, the diversity of species, has remained pretty much the same. It's changing a little bit now because of global warming, and spring is occurring 2 weeks earlier. So the species that drop off in that area and stay there for the summer are beginning to change slightly. But pretty much it's the same that we've had. However, the total numbers are dropping off to the point where we've actually had a silent spring in 2015, a silent spring in 2020, and another silent spring last year in 2023.
How about the insect sounds in those forests, in that forest, Bernie?
Also dropped off significantly. A colleague of mine who's also recording with me said when he goes out in his car now, he doesn't see any bugs on his windshield. And which is normal for this time of year because it's pretty dense insect-wise typically. And for the last couple of years, he hasn't seen any bugs splattered on his windshield as he drives down the highway here.
Hildegard?
I'm not as connected in that specialized way to nature as Bernie is. And I live in the city. I live in Vancouver. And I did not make exclusively nature recordings all my life. And so I find it difficult to comment in this sort of general way to this. What I can say is that society has not become quieter. We have maybe made efforts to reduce sound levels of mechanical sounds, any kind of machine sounds, but there's more of it, and it's just a proliferation of noise all over. And so I think it might be interesting to talk about just when the pandemic started and there was a sudden quiet in the city, in my neighborhood. Bird life was really audible. And that doesn't mean that it wasn't there before. It probably was, but we heard it. And that had a really positive effect on many people. Subsequently, right next door to me, I've had 2 years of house construction, and now on one side and now on the other side. And I've noticed that, first of all, that noise is much more dominating than whatever birdsong there might still be. And I hear them at night, but I believe they're not around as much. And that's understandable, of course. I didn't study this, but it's just an observation. And so to me, it's a kind of a nucleus of what's happening everywhere, is that the noise proliferation is so huge. And that the noise is just simply the voice of what we've been doing through the planet. It just tells us what we're doing. And so the quieter voices of nature, relatively quieter noises of nature, are less audible and maybe disappearing. But what's also disappearing is our attention to those sounds, the listening to them, because we are preoccupied with the busyness of this society. And that disappearance, I think, is really, really dangerous, because it means we're losing connection to nature on a daily basis, whether it's in the city or anywhere, really.
And when you see people in the city, like I have lived for years on and off in Hamilton, Ontario, and we've got Coots Paradise on the western end of Burlington Bay in Lake Ontario, and it's a gorgeous natural place. It's on the Niagara Escarpment, and it's a splendid natural location. And I go walking there, and I see people, you know, Steeltown, Hamilton, Ontario, walking through nature, and they're wearing earbuds. They've got their earbuds on, and they're listening to their audio devices. And I'm thinking, take them off and listen to nature. But people aren't used to doing that in the city, are they?
It's a signal of that loss of disconnection, that it's not interesting enough to listen to nature. It's not really anything that fascinates. What's more interesting is to listen to music or to listen to podcasts like this one. And, how can we create a new passion for knowing about nature? And I mean, I think there is an urgency now because of the climate crisis, and many people do see the urgency. And so that needs to be encouraged. We need to be clear about that urgency, because it gets us off our butts to actually do something.
What sorts of animal wildlife sounds, Hildegard, do you hear in Vancouver on a quiet night, in the morning, early?
Mostly bird song, songbirds and crows. Canada geese come over regularly at a certain time, and dogs. That's about it.
Bernie Krause, it's amazing. You may want to comment on jump off what Hildegard's just said, but I mean, nature makes sounds. We think of birds, we think of insects, obviously. And on a early in the morning, boy, sound forests, even in the city, are just ringing with the sounds of birds and sometimes insects. But, you know, soil makes sounds. Soil organisms generate sounds, and trees generate sounds, not just the branches and the leaves waving in the breeze, but I gather people can stick microphones into the bark and capture sounds.
Well, I've been doing that for quite a while. Yes, we recorded the sound of water going up the xylem and the phloem of trees and the trunks of trees. And actually recorded, we were recording bats. And as we got closer to this tree, we heard this very high frequency signal. And so we inserted a little hydrophone in the trunk of the tree. And lo and behold, we had an instrumentation device with us, and we recorded this sound at around 70 kilohertz, about three or four times the frequency of the highest note that humans can hear. And sure enough, when we slowed that sound up, when we got it back to the lab and slowed it up, it sounded like pops. And what was happening was, it sounded like this. And what happened was, the cells in the xylem and the phloem were trying to suck in air to maintain osmotic pressure, since it had been so dry in that area for a long time. These were cottonwood trees in Utah. And when the cells suck in too much air, they pop and die and form the rings around the tree. But it puts out this sound, and the tree begins to exude some liquid that the insects are drawn to. So the insects are drawn to the tree, the birds are drawn to the insects, and so on and so forth. So it creates a whole biome by itself. That was one thing, and we've done a lot of work dropping hydrophones down into wet soil to hear earthworms moving through the soil. People wonder what robins hear sometimes. Well, maybe they're picking up that kind of signal as well. So we've done that, and I want to comment a little bit on what Hildegard was saying, because it's so important, and it's true, because noise is partly a consequence of the times that we're living in. And that's signified by the ways in which we're drawn to all the distractions, like the noise of omnipresent media in our lives. And I think that the further we draw away from natural world encounters that we need to sustain and calm us, and the further we draw away from the natural world, the more pathological we become as a culture. And if you don't believe that, kind of just watch the news. Yeah, and we're screaming in rage for attention in an effort to mitigate the obvious inequalities and lack of being seen and otherwise heard. And another thing I want to say about Hildegard's comment is that in the cities, there seems to be a rich return of wildlife. I mean, I was just up in Vancouver a few weeks ago, and sure enough, downtown, which is where we were staying, was just alive with bird sound. And I was really kind of astonished that when I opened up the window in the hotel we were staying in, we heard bird sound that we hadn't heard before. And even though we were smack in the middle of the city, I think that there are sounds of organisms that we don't even imagine. Recorded ants in 1984, for instance, singing. Well, what they were doing, they weren't really singing. They were stridulating. They were rubbing their legs on their abdomen and creating this sound and trying to draw the other ants away from the hole that we had, the ant hole that we had dropped our microphone, a little lavalier microphone into. And so they were trying to distract them and move them away from it by sound. They were communicating by sound instead of pheromone. And so we have some really interesting things we haven't ever explored before.
Well, I was just thinking the advantage that birds have in cities is that they are heard over the noise because they're in the high frequencies. And so we do notice them. And I think it's the same in Europe. The bird life in the cities is really quite vibrant. But I can't believe you didn't visit me, Bernie. You were in Vancouver.
I didn't know you were there. I was going to say that, Hildegard. I didn't know you were there.
The cities here in the Netherlands can get really quiet. Like, I live in Breda, which is, I don't know, what's the population of Breda? It's maybe 50,000 people just south of Rotterdam. And sometimes in the evening, I walk through the streets and it's just quiet. It's so incredibly quiet. I can't believe it. It's like the Dutch, right? They go inside their homes and they get quiet.